This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. I appreciate you giving your time to us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. We have a real treat on today's program. Thanksgiving is tomorrow in the United States. This is a holiday that tends to get overshadowed by Christmas and buried under commercialism, but it's a deeply meaningful holiday, both for the virtues that it celebrates and the history that it recalls. Later in today's program, we're going to receive a terrific history lesson from trumpet writer Andrew Miller. This month marks 400 years since the first pilgrims came to America in the Plymouth Colony under Governor William Bradford. We'll look at an important lesson learned by those early Americans. As we feast this Thanksgiving, we shouldn't overlook an important warning just issued by the United Nations. The head of the World Food Bank says massive famines could hit hundreds of millions of people this coming year because of the economic impacts of the COVID-19. In some underdeveloped nations, it's already driving more people into deprivation, even starvation. In our first segment, we'll hear from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this warning of famines of, quote, biblical proportions. And one more story in this special Thanksgiving edition of Trumpet Hour related to coronavirus. We'll talk about an underappreciated way to protect yourself from the virus. And it might be particularly relevant if you want to enjoy a second helping of pumpkin pie. If you want to increase your resistance to COVID-19, you can do more than just wash your hands and wear a mask. We'll talk to personal trainer Jorg Mardian about an aspect of protecting yourself that, in my view, we don't hear nearly enough about. That is exercise. And we'll finish off the program today with some thoughts from Herbert W. Armstrong in 1945 on why even democracy fails. Let's begin, though, by looking at this warning of potential for famine. We'll hear about this in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
The head of the United Nations World Food Program, Mr. David Beasley, warned last week that in 2021, the world could face famines of what he called biblical proportions. This was during an interview with the Associated Press, and Beasley spoke about what a tough year 2020 has been for food insecure nations. That's mostly because of the shutdowns and lockdowns that have been implemented by governments around the world in an attempt to slow the spread of COVID-19. Those lockdowns eviscerated certain industries and disrupted global value and supply chains. They put great pressure on agricultural production and plunged countless people into severe hardship. Beasley says that back in April, there was fear that all of the economic disruption and the surge in poverty would cause major food shortages in low and middle income nations. At that time, 135 million people faced what he called crisis levels of hunger or worse. But national governments responded to the disruptions with cash handouts, domestic food aid programs, stimulus packages, and deferral of many kinds of debt. And then international aid programs, like the World Food Bank that Beasley leads, went into overdrive, moving massive amounts of food from wealthy and generous nations, mainly the United States, to the most vulnerable populations around the globe. So during 2020, the crisis was mostly averted. But the trouble is that the economic disruptions are far from over, and resources are far from infinite. Beasley said COVID-19 is now surging again, and many economies are not recovering. Some are continuing to deteriorate, particularly in developing countries. And even though there has been news of vaccines, the rollout of those may be a long way off for some vulnerable regions. And that delay will likely mean another wave of lockdowns and shutdowns. Beasley says the reason why this is alarming is because the money that was available in 2020 won't be available in 2021. He said, quote, "This tragedy that we are facing are crises that really are going to be extraordinary over the next, who knows, 12 to 18 months. And then he said, world leaders are not going to have enough money to fund all the projects they historically fund. He said to avert famines next year, $15 billion in additional funds would be needed, and he doesn't know where such an amount would come from. An analysis published earlier this month by the World Food Program and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says that the most vulnerable nations are Burkina Faso, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Yemen. They've all reached what the report calls a critical hunger situation. And then the scenario is not much better for parts of Afghanistan, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Congo, Ethiopia, Haiti, Lebanon, Mali, Mozambique, Niger, Sierra Leone, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. All of those are categorized as being in need of urgent attention. So altogether, the number of people who will be at risk of starvation next year is approaching 270 million. 270 million people who don't know how long their food supplies will last in their homes, in their regions, and in their nations. Beasley says the approaching crisis is similar to the situation the Titanic faced. And he said, quote, "Right now, we really need to focus on icebergs. And icebergs are famine, starvation, destabilization, and migration. If these are ignored," he said, "the world will suffer," quote, "famines of biblical proportions in 2021. It makes sense in a warning about famine to mention the Bible. The Bible records the history of several notable famines. The first, covered in Genesis chapter 12, was so severe it compelled the patriarch Abraham to flee to Egypt. Another one recorded in Genesis 26 occurred during the lifetime of Abraham's son Isaac and prompted him to take refuge in Gerar. Then Genesis 41 through 44 records a particularly grievous famine that struck Egypt while Isaac's grandson Joseph dwelt there. That one lasted for 7 agonizing years. Then 1 Chronicles 21 discusses a bout of disease and famine that resulted in the death of 70,000 people. And the list of historic famines recorded in the scriptures goes on. But the Bible also says that many of the worst famines would occur after the scriptures were written. In Revelation 6, the Apostle John discusses the 7 seals that lead to the dramatic end of the age of man attempting to rule over himself. The first 4 of these, discussed in verses 1 through 8, are often called the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. They represent religious deception, war, famine, and pestilence. Regarding the third horse and its rider, the passage states, "I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the 4 beasts say, 'A measure of wheat for a penny, and 3 measures of barley for a penny, and see that you hurt not the oil and the wine.'" This is a personification of famine. It's painted as being severe, relentless, and discriminating. Discriminating because it shows that scarcity of staple grains will be so great that they will be meticulously weighed and prohibitively expensive. But luxury goods, meanwhile, like wine and oil, will still be available for wealthy people. But for those staple grains that most people rely so much on, Ellicott's commentary says, "Measure in verse 6 means the amount of food sufficient to support a man for one day. And penny refers to the usual daily pay of the laborer and of the soldier. So this means an entire day's wage would allow a man to buy only enough wheat to feed himself for that same day. Or he could buy enough of the less nutritious barley to feed 3 for one day. This would make the feeding of a family almost impossible for a single wage earner. So this is an insufferable situation that will afflict many, many people. And Revelation isn't the only biblical book to discuss mass famines that will happen, extending even into the modern era. During his ministry on earth, Jesus Christ said that mass famines would unfold prior to his return. Matthew 24:7 records him as saying, quote, "For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines." Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury and co-author Mr. Wayne Turgeon write about the approaching return of famine in their booklet, The 4 Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And they stress that these prophecies are mainly about the present age. They write, quote, "We are not discussing some dusty old prophecies. These are dramatic, dire prophecies that lie directly in front of us. This third horseman of famine will have a specific fulfillment. It is ready to gallop into our immediate future with an impact far beyond the historic and present-day occurrences of localized famines. And then they write, "Great famine will eventually spread to every corner of the earth." Mr. Fleury and Mr. Turgeon explained that although this points to a future of terrible human suffering, the Bible makes clear that God will provide an escape for those who will embrace Him. They write, "The future appears very bleak, but there is a way of escape. God will hear and forgive anyone who will repent. The only ones promised divine protection are those few who have yielded to God and His way of life." So from these scriptures and from this analysis of them from Mr. Fleury, we can see that David Beasley and others with the World Food Program are right to be concerned about future famines of biblical proportions. It's clear that the Black Horseman is not finished riding. But as Mr. Fleury and Mr. Turgeon write, each individual has some say about whether he or she will be in his path or not.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. It is remarkable how many of the effects that we're seeing, everything that you're describing here, is ripple effects from the coronavirus, and not just coronavirus, but the lockdowns that have come as a result of that. And everything that you're describing, it's being so overwhelmed by other headlines that are in the news and all of the enthusiasm for more lockdowns, really people aren't paying attention to just how many people's lives are being affected down the chain.
I think that's a great point. Yes, we've got so much chaos right now with the U.S. election situation and just many other stories that this is overlooked quite a bit. But I think you also make a good point just about the connection between disease and famine. You know, that's not just with the coronavirus, which we see happening now in an interesting way, because it's actually causing these economies to shut down, which in turn leads to a lot of economic hardship and financial hardship. But there's also a connection between famine and disease in the sense that when a person is starving, their body begins to break down muscle tissue in order to keep the heart and the other vital organs functioning. And at that point, the immune system is terribly compromised. And so a person becomes highly susceptible to communicable diseases at that point. So the actual cause of death for someone who's starving is often a disease that he catches because of his compromised immune system. So that's how the two are usually connected. But what we have today is kind of a new dimension that brings in disease first and then the famine.
The prophecy that you mentioned there at the end of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, famine is one of those horsemen. Disease is another of those horsemen. And a lot of times, war is another cause of famine. When countries go to war, then there's a lot of devastation that results, and food production is disrupted. There are a lot of connections between these that aren't necessarily discussed explicitly in that prophecy, but they very much are connected, and the destruction that they wreak is very very evident in the world around us.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I think that's why they're discussed so closely in Scripture, to show the connection between them as well.
So you mentioned that Revelation 6 prophecy. I think it was back in our April 2020 print edition that our editor in chief, Gerald Fleury, he was talking about the coronavirus in prophecy. This was in the very early stages of when that started to make headlines. And he pointed to a prophecy over in Zechariah 6 that is relevant to that. Can you teach us about that?
Yeah, sure. Yes, he in that article, really powerful article, and he does discuss the four horsemen that the Apostle John wrote about there in Revelation. And then, as you said, he connects it to Zechariah chapter 6. And he explains that there's a close connection between those two chapters. Verses 1 through 3 of Zechariah 6 are about four chariots drawn by what look to be horses, and they emerge from between two mountains. And Mr. Fleury explains that these mountains represent the two present members of the God family. And the horses are actually angelic beings that the Creator sends out to the earth to correct mankind. So in this case, the black horses represent not just famine, but also violence and disease altogether. So the symbolism really ties those together, like the connection that you mentioned a moment ago. And this is, it's very interesting and encouraging, I think, because the language in this passage shows that God is in careful control of exactly how much devastation he allows these plagues to inflict on mankind. Mr. Fleury writes in one part, quote, "God is in close control over exactly how much devastation these beings are allowed to unleash. He is not destroying indiscriminately. He is punishing the world in love and in measure to help mankind turn from the paths of destruction to the way of truth and peace. God will allow the diseases and other afflictions represented by these horses to affect mankind to precisely the degree needed to help them repent. No more, no less." End quote. So, you know, we know that this is done in love to actually help mankind end his rebellion toward God.
It's very good to have that spiritual perspective, and especially as we enjoy Thanksgiving and most of us having plenty to remember those who do not. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the potential for devastating famine in the wake of economic problems caused by coronavirus. He's working on an article on this subject. Do watch for that at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Exercise is good for you. People who exercise tend to have fuller, healthier lives, protection from disease, better recovery from illness, longer life. Well, now research is showing that these benefits may even extend to protection from COVID-19. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
So you're in the business of helping people exercise, but I understand you're entering another coronavirus shutdown. So if there's benefits to exercise, I guess the government doesn't see it that way, huh?
That's right. Exercise, the gyms and the studios seem to be the first to be shut down, no matter how much we ask them or tell them that there is a clear-cut benefit to, you know, just the respiratory aspect, getting oxygen into the body and that, but they don't seem to agree with us.
Well, let's talk about that. It's been said that exercise is medicine. You're obviously in that business, so you have pretty strong opinions about that. What does that mean, exercise is medicine?
Well, exercise is medicine. Really, it's exactly what it means. It has a medicinal effect upon the body, and the government recognizes that when it wants to. So the action of the physical activity is really about doing something that moves the body, with the end point being to change the physical function of the body. You're doing something better. You're making it better. So if we dig into the benefits, we find that exercise is far-reaching, and it affects all the parts of the body, from the immune system to the brain, to the individual energy system within the cellular structure itself. I mean, it's quite fascinating. And the goal is to think of exercise as medicine, so it's a therapy that can be prescribed in specific doses for specific needs. And doctors will actually prescribe medicine and say, hey, you need to move to get healthier. So now that way of thinking can be a benefit to the current viral landscape that we're in. So at the moment, there's so many people with pre-existing conditions, and that's coupled with old age, and those are major reasons for these premature coronavirus deaths. And then now, here we're in a lockdown again, and so being immobilized, people are in hospitals, people have home bed rest, people have a lack of physical activity. due to lockups. If you add that to the mix, that can really hinder the ability of the organs to resist the coronavirus infection. So I would say exercise gives us some specific abilities to counteract the biggest side effects of the coronavirus.
So what are the main benefits, would you say, talking about coronavirus specifically, how can exercise help you to resist that?
Right. Well, there's hundreds and hundreds of benefits. I'm just going to talk about four of the big ones right now. So the first one is research tells us that if we exercise, you show a reduced risk of what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. Mm. And that's one of the more lethal complications of this coronavirus. So ARDS is a disease where you get lung tissue injury, inflammation, and respiratory failure. The CDC says that up to 42% of patients that are hospitalized for COVID-19 will develop ARDS.
Wow.
And about half of those will die. So it's not a small issue. Unsurprisingly, it happens more with people who don't exercise. And so they have reduced lung capacity as well as older people.
Mm-hmm.
So the second benefit is it ramps up production of what's called extracellular superoxide dismutase. Now that's an antioxidant. And that targets the free radicals in the body and it protects the body's tissue from disease. So basically, in a nutshell, it enables an infected person to more effectively endure the coronavirus. So as we exercise, we ramp up production of this antioxidant and it gives us protection.
And is that you're talking about someone who is in the habit of exercising has that benefit, or someone who's actually infected with coronavirus, if they exercise, that they would gain that benefit?
Well, you'll gain that benefit exercising. I want to make sure to say that you can't just exercise and say, I have 100% protection. It doesn't work like that. And there's no way to prove that. But if you exercise and you help your body, say, with this antioxidant and you ramp that up, being in this business for over 20 years, I would say, yes, that's definitely going to help you in at least in the recovery aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a virus and anybody can catch a virus. It's how the body deals with a virus.
Mm-hmm.
And then and that gets us to the third point of the immune system. You know, depending on the exercise that you do, the intensity and the duration, you immediately have circulating white blood cells that increase by 50 to 400%. And that's immediate. Now, these white blood cells, as you're exercising, they increase and they kill infected cells in the upper respiratory tract and the lungs. And that's where the COVID hits us the hardest.
Hmm.
So, and as well, another wonderful aspect of the immunity is that it develops antibodies. And that likely provides some reinfection protection further down the road.
Hmm.
And the fourth big gun of exercise, the way that it helps us, is heart health. Based on what we know today, elderly people with coronary heart disease or high blood pressure, they're increasingly susceptible to coronavirus. So data from Wuhan, China, it shows us that there's a 10.5% death rate among people that have those symptoms. So, but there's good news. So if you exercise, you help lower blood pressure and you prevent hypertension. It's not immediate, of course, it takes time. But as you keep exercising, you remove one of the risk factors for developing more severe symptoms, again, of the virus. So, and that's been shown in study after study. So basically, the healthier you are as you keep exercising, the better it is for you. And then so jump on that exercise bandwagon and start reaping the benefits over time.
That's a lot of benefits. That's a pretty strong medicine against this, it sounds like. But you mentioned the, I guess, the intensity and the duration of the exercise, that if basically you're prescribing this as medicine for this this virus in particular, what are the specifics that you would recommend for someone in terms of dosage?
Right. So we really do want to tell people to, at the beginning, at least, to get into some kind of aerobic exercises, because that benefits the lungs, and as well as some resistance training. So evidence shows that 150 minutes of moderate activity, they say less than an hour, is a good initial target for everybody. And that's a great start for people. So you want to at least get the aerobic component and the strength component in. And then if you're able to include some high intensity interval training as well, really work those lungs. That's really important in fighting this virus. And then from the 150 minutes on, just increase that as you're able to, as your time allows.
And this is 150 minutes per week, per day?
Per week, yes.
Okay.
That to me is a beginning stage, you know. We have a lot of minutes in a week, so we need to fill those up each day. An hour a day is 5 days a week at least, is a great way to exercise. If you can't, just do what your body allows or your time allows. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is consistency. If you don't have consistency, like I said, it's not going to benefit you, because the benefits are transitory. So that really means you're going to see steady improvements if you put in continual time and effort to maintain those benefits. Mm-hmm. So you can't do a week and say, I'm good to go. If you haven't exercised a lot in the past, you know, start with walking, jogging, swimming, riding a bike. Anything helps. If you're recovering from coronavirus, now you're in more of a fragile state, so an exercise routine is absolutely going to help you with recovery, but you have to do it in a stepwise approach. That means don't bite off more than you can chew early on. You know, just go as you are able to.
What would you recommend the kinds of resistance training that someone might start if they're not accustomed to doing that type of thing? Where would you start them?
Well, resistance training, if you have not done anything, I would say just go, you know, you can go to a gym and you can ask somebody with knowledge, or you can go and ask a trainer. A lot of people come to me and say, just show me what to do and I'll do it at home, which is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, you need some weights, maybe a small exercise ball, a stepper. At home you can do it. And then you just need to find out how to lift those weights safely. And that's the key part, because if you're going to do it by yourself and guess at it, you might hurt yourself. So it might always be good to take an hour, spend some money with a trainer and say, teach me, put something on paper, and then I can do that at home. Mm-hmm. And that's a safe way to do it. Or you can do it at the gym as well.
Well, it's good advice. Any final words for anyone that is looking to protect themselves from coronavirus and looking at exercise as the medicine that might help them?
Right. So from all my experience over the years, I can say for certain that without a regular pattern of exercise, you're going to get frail in time. And that's going to eventually blur into some type of disease pattern. Exercise is actually crucial to our life. So none of this says that we're not going to become infected. We can exercise a lot, but surely it's going to dampen the heavy viral symptoms, and it's going to accelerate the recovery time if we're exercising consistently. So that should be fantastic news to get more active, get more consistent, stay motivated, and just make consistent fitness a priority, knowing it's good for you.
I really wish that with all of the time that the news media spend on coronavirus, that we heard more of this type of message. We spoke last month about nutrition and the role that nutrition can play. We'll put a link to that interview in our show notes for today's program. Here we're talking about exercise. These are proactive steps that people can take to mitigate the effects of coronavirus in your own life, rather than just talking about staying away from other people entirely or shutting your life down, closing businesses, wearing a mask over your face, taking proactive steps that improve your immunity and improve your health and increase your resistance to these to the virus and the problems that it causes really is a much healthier way to go about it. We appreciate that very much. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about the role that exercise can play in protecting you from coronavirus and recovery from it if you do happen to get it. He's working on an article about this that you will find at thetrumpet.com soon. We thank you very much for your time, Jörg.
My pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Thanksgiving in America recalls some inspiring and important history, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
This month marks 400 years since the Pilgrims landed on the shores of Massachusetts, and the story of how they established the Plymouth Colony and celebrated the first Thanksgiving is repeated every year in America. This version of the story tells of how 102 pilgrims arrived at Plymouth Colony in the middle of winter in 1620. It tells how 45 of those pilgrims starved to death their very first winter. It tells of how the pilgrims befriended the friendly Indians Samoset and Squanto, worked hard all summer, and then had a great Thanksgiving feast that autumn. But if you have heard this version of the story, you have not heard the whole truth. The pilgrims did give thanks to God in a great Thanksgiving feast in 1621, but the harvest was not bountiful. They only had a fraction of the food they needed for the upcoming winter. And so the feast was really more of the last meal of condemned men rather than a joyous celebration. Many more pilgrims starved that winter and the following winter. And it was not until they learned a vital lesson about the Bible that Plymouth Colony was truly blessed with abundance. Now, something most people don't know about the pilgrims is that they were communist. And when I say communist, I mean they ran Plymouth Plantation as a commune. They pooled their resources, they shared their production. Those more capable would do their part for the colony, and those more needy would get a share. Pilgrim Governor William Bradford actually called this system communalism 195 years before Karl Marx was even born. But it was not long before Bradford realized something had gone terribly wrong. In his History of Plymouth Plantation, Bradford wrote of how the young men resented being forced to work for other men's wives and children. The old men resented receiving the same rations as those who had not served the community as long. Wives resented having to wash the clothes of men who were not their husbands. And the end result is that many went hungry because they refused to work. Bradford even talks about pilgrims selling themselves out as servants to the local Indians, chopping wood for the Indian tribes in exchange for just a cupful of corn to eat. But Bradford learned a lesson from all this suffering, and this is what he records in his memoirs of Plymouth Plantation.
The experience that was had in this common course and condition, tried sundry years, and that amongst godly and sober men, may well evince the vanity of that conceit of Plato and other ancients, applauded by some of later times, that the taking away of property and bringing in community into a commonwealth would make them happy and flourishing, as if they were wiser than God. For this community, so far as it was found to breed much confusion and discontent, and retard much employment that would have been to their benefit and comfort. For the young men that were most able and fit for labor and service did repine that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without any recompense. The strong or man of parts had no more in division of victuals and clothes than he that was weak and not able to do a quarter the other could. This was thought injustice. The aged and graver men to be ranked and equalized in labors and victuals clothes with the meaner and younger sort thought it some indignity and disrespect unto them, and for men's wives to be commanded to do service for other men as dressing their meat, washing their clothes, they deemed it a kind of slavery, neither could many husbands well brook it. Upon the point all being to have alike and all to do alike, they thought themselves in the like condition, and one as good as another. And so, if it did not cut off those relations that God has set among men, yet it did at least much diminish and take of the mutual respect that should be preserved among them, and would have been worse if they had been men of another condition. Let none object this is men's corruption, and nothing to the course itself. I answer, seeing all men have this corruption in them, God in his wisdom saw another course fitter for them.
After 3 years of such confusion, discontent, and starvation, Governor Bradford rectified this situation by abolishing communalism. He gave each household a parcel of land and told them they could keep what they produced or trade it away as they saw fit. And the change was startling. People who had previously refused to work now went to the fields willingly. And they grew so much food that there was great abundance during the Thanksgiving feast of 1623. And by the Thanksgiving feast of 1624, the pilgrims were growing so much corn that they were actually exporting it for profit to the surrounding colonies. As you heard from Bradford in his journal, he repented of his role in establishing Plymouth as a commune, saying that he had esteemed the conceits of Plato and other ancients above the laws of God. The Greek philosopher Plato rejected the concept of family and the concept of private property in his book, The Republic. But God says, if any provide not for his own, and especially those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Like many Americans today, the pilgrims were thankful for the food they had during the first Thanksgiving, but many had to starve to death before they became truly thankful for the law of God. And so that's the great hidden lesson of the first Thanksgiving that we need to take from this vital history and remember this Thanksgiving Day, that we need to certainly give thanks for the food and other blessings God has given us. But above all, we need to give thanks for the laws of God that show us how to have such abundance.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That is history you're not going to hear about from too many places today, particularly from the people who love socialism and the fact that this happened in a way that really shows the how socialism goes against human nature in many ways, but also the ones who want to say that the pilgrims were not peace-loving people who had friendly relations with the Indians, but that they were genocidal maniacs.
Right. You know, definitely. Yeah, like I said, it is amazing that this year is exactly 400 years since the pilgrims landed in Massachusetts. And so it's been a while, but we have the primary sources that this concept was actually quite common when America was first founded. You can tell a similar story about Jamestown, Virginia. It's not as dramatic because we don't have the first hand accounts like we have from William Bradford, but they also tried to establish a commune in Jamestown and went through a starving time for their first several years in the New World until they started having each family take responsibility for itself. So that's a lesson that America's founders learned the hard way, seeing winter after winter having half the colony die. And then Bradford very kindly wrote down his experience mm-hmm. and left it for posterity, lest anyone else start making the same mistakes as right. he did. So he was hoping to help America learn a lesson. And the founders who came after him did, but it seems that here we are four centuries later, America's entering a time where they unfortunately might need to learn that lesson the hard way again.
Well, yeah, he was a man who knew his Bible, and it is interesting the fact that he contrasted what he called the ideas of Plato against the laws of God, and the fact that the people who were trying to make this socialistic type system work were actually working against God's law.
Right, and that is a huge benefit that I guess William Bradford had, having known his Bible so well, is that I've heard from a lot of even media figures and Democratic figures talking about how well Jesus was actually a socialist, because he gave food to the poor and cherry picking a scripture here and cherry picking a scripture there, and it doesn't take very much to prove, if you're willing to look into it, that though they may be espousing a similar economic system to what the Pilgrims practiced when they first got here, they definitely don't know the laws of God or their Bible like the Pilgrims did.
What do you make of the people who are looking back at early American history, the Pilgrims migrating from Europe, and describing them kind of on the same sort of terms as, say, what happened with the Aztecs in South America?
Right. I think that's really a big, makes a strong case for the importance of reading primary historical sources, in that, like, yeah, you can read Howard Zinn's People of America and take it for granted that that's just how it was. But if you actually go back, and there's plenty of primary historical sources of what happened during this, that actually Bradford's recounting that when the Pilgrims first got here, in some ways they were almost kind of a subservient to the native Indian tribes. They're cutting wood for their local Indian tribe in return for a cupful of corn so they don't starve to death. And then after they did abolish communalism and get on their feet, it recounts very good relations with the local Indian tribes. It wasn't till 16 years later that they had their first conflict between the Massachusetts colonist and the Indians, and that is something that if you start looking at, I don't know, like BuzzFeed's 10 dark things you didn't know about the Pilgrims, they'll bring that up, as they're like, oh, well, they conducted a midnight raid against this Indian tribe. But if you actually, like, again, look at the primary sources, you'll find that even that war was mostly a war over fur trading routes between two Indian tribes. And the one Indian tribe was allies with the Dutch, and the other Indian tribes was allies with the British. So some of the colonists eventually got involved in the conflict, but that conflict was not between the Pilgrims and the Indians who helped them at the first Thanksgiving. That was between the Massachusetts colonists, their Indian allies, and some other tribe from further inland, who was trying to take over their territory.
Yeah, it is definitely a wonderful idea for Americans in particular to go read that history, to read the primary sources, dig into it. We need to make American history great again, because it really has been ravaged by people who just want to turn everything that is associated with America into something dark and perverse. But really, there is so much to be inspired about. We really appreciate you bringing those lessons to us today, Andrew. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some lessons from some of the first Pilgrims in America, just in time for Thanksgiving tomorrow. He's working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks again, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's Last Word.
I want to read excerpts from a transcript of a radio broadcast by Herbert W. Armstrong from November 4th, 1945. And he explains in this segment why even democracy fails. He spoke this right after America had emerged victorious from World War II
And he boldly said that America was at the most dangerous hour of its history. Let's look once again then to the real causes of war. When the eternal God first created man and placed him on this earth, all was perfect harmony and beauty. All things in the universe operate according to fixed law. There are the laws that keep the planets, sun, stars traveling in their prescribed courses through the heavens. On earth is the law of gravity, the law of inertia, the laws of physics and chemistry. There are laws that regulate the physical body, and your physical health depends on not violating them. And then of necessity, there is a great fundamental, inexorable spiritual law to regulate man's relations with man and man's relations to his creator. This spiritual law might be called the law of love. It is a principle, a way of life. It is an attitude of mind and heart, the correct way to think and to live. This is the way of living that puts the premium upon giving, not getting. This spiritual law was designed to protect man's welfare and happiness. And just as breaking the physical laws of the body result in suffering, sickness, or death, so it is that when this spiritual law is broken, unhappiness, suffering, both physical and spiritual, and all kinds of anguish come as the penalty. This world chaos is merely the penalty of the broken law. Take a quick glance now at how it developed. Nimrod built the first city, Babylon, then Uruk, Akkad, and Calneh. At first, the world was organized only into city-states. Each city had its own king. Soon, one king cast greedy, lustful eyes over a neighboring city or two. So he organized a large number of his men into an army, a fighting force, to march over to the neighboring city and take it by force. Soon, the stronger, more cunning kings were ruling over two, three, then several cities, and nations were born. And as nations organized armies and fought wars, empires came into being. Businessmen in each city or nation fought methods of competition against their rival businessmen. All society came to be organized on this selfish getting basis. God was ignored. Man exalted himself and other men. As time went on and the system developed, some men specialized in politics, seeking to rule over people through government. Others specialized in business, seeking to amass great fortunes and to rule behind cover over the politicians. But even in the phases of religion and social activity, the competitive principle was dominant. There have been various forms of government, but remember this. Every single government in this world, of whatever form, whether communism, fascism, autocracy, or yes, even democracy, is merely a different method of administering this same overall Babylonish system. And it's the system which is the root cause of this world's ills and of wars. This system is a way of life. It's a way contrary to the laws of God, contrary to his revealed social, economic, and civil laws, as well as the great spiritual law. In religious language, it's the way of sin, because the Bible defines sin as the transgression of the law, 1 John 3:4. And as a spiritual principle, as you'll read in Romans 7 and verse 14, that law is a spiritual law. That law still operates, just as the law of gravity still operates, or the law of inertia, or the laws of physics or chemistry. And the more that law is transgressed, the more unhappiness, anguish, suffering, and death this world brings upon itself as a penalty. In every phase of our present civilization, our political organizations, our economic system, our social customs, even religious organization, is diametrically contrary to God's law as a revealed way of life. The real cause of wars is this whole competitive system, organized with certain selfish motivated scheming men always in control. What then is the solution? Wars can be prevented only by one strong enough to be a world ruler, clear-sighted and wise enough to completely change the existing system, to abolish all competition, to put the premium on giving instead of getting, to do away entirely with all regimentation with the present economic system, the present social system, in fact, with the whole of present society. He would have to be good enough and honest enough to rule this whole world for the good of the governed, not for the greed and pride of the ruler. And finally, that man would have to change human nature, because as long as man remains selfish, he will continue on this competitive and Babylonish system. Yes, it will take a world ruler, a ruler who is the perfect man, one who will rule with fairness and justice, one who has power to abolish this entire world system and start the whole world going on the basis of love. One who will not take any selfish advantage of his great power, but will rule only for the good of his subjects. One who has the power to change men's minds and hearts, to change the very nature of man. Only one such man ever lived, Jesus Christ. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Jorg Mardian, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Cultivate the habit of being grateful for every good thing that comes to you, and to give thanks continuously. And because all things have contributed to your advancement, you should include all things in your gratitude. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.